All right, we, let's see, got to get my red pen out. Okay, I think we talked about chronoamperometry last class. I know we did. This is our eighth lecture on electrochemistry, and as I have been doing, I'll review a couple of the slides from last class. And so here we have what I discussed at the end of last class, chronoamperometry. I didn't mention this, but it's a big word, chronoamperometry, but if you think about it, chrono means time, right? Some people have a chronograph. Okay, I don't have one. I have a cell phone. People don't, you know, watches are becoming obsolete, as fate would have it. So it deals with time. It deals with amps or amperometry, the idea that we're going to measure current. And then, of course, the last part of this means that we're measuring, we're metering, okay? So we're metering the current, okay, versus time. And so the chronoamperometry experiment is, of course, it's a fixed potential applied to the electrochemical cell. We're electrolyzing the system, and we're measuring the current versus time. So the big name actually means something. We said it was a stationary electrode. It's unstirred, so it's a mass transport by diffusion, and therefore it's a Cottrell type of system. We have a constant potential, fixed potential, and we're measuring current versus time, as I stated. The system that I set up was an oxidized form of some species gets reduced, and both ox and red are soluble species. It's electrochemically reversible. Okay, electrochemically reversible system. That just means the kinetics are fast, and we don't have to worry about anything to do with slow kinetics from the electrochemical reaction. We do set the potential such that the reaction goes to completion at the electrode surface, meaning if we were to look at the Nernst equation, the E applied, now Nernst equation in potentiometry, we just measured the potential, and that was related to the concentration of the species at the electrode surface and so forth. But now in voltammetry-type systems, we are electrolyzing, we're applying voltage to the system, and here the Nernst equation is used for the E applied, the potential that's applied to the system. And so we set that potential such that the right-hand side of the Nernst equation, those concentrations over there on the right-hand side of the equation, are at equilibrium. When the Nernst equation is satisfied at equilibrium, it's going to drive the reaction far to the right. In other words, ox plus n electrons goes to red is going to go far, far to the right. We're going to drive that thing until pretty much all the ox is used up, and we've got a maximum amount of the reduced species produced. So that's what this statement at the bottom of the slide is talking about. We said that the curve looks like this. Now, the chronoamperometry experiment, whenever in any electrochemical experiment, when you're measuring current, you cannot per se differentiate between the kinds of current that you see. In other words, you just see current, right? So it's not. So I've split them up in a Faradaic current and a capacitive current, but you can't see the difference. They just come out together. Okay, the two currents come out together. So, but if you could see them, okay, if you could see the difference between these two currents, the Faradaic and the capacitive current, the Faradaic current would follow the Cottrell equation perfectly. Okay, and I refer to it as I far for I Faradaic, and the capacitive current would decay exponentially, I cap. I think originally I used I capacitive. Okay, then when I lulled you into complacency, thinking I was going to write I capacitive out, I switched it to I cap, and then pretty soon you're going to see that I'm going to write IC. Okay, but at any rate, the idea here is that capacitive current drops off exponentially. That charging current from the ions in solution migrating to the electrode surface because of the potential that's applied, that drops off with an exponential decay. The Faradaic current drops off with, according to the Cottrell equation. So the two things are working a little bit differently, and I mentioned also that this diagram is a little misleading in that it would take a long time, as we discussed, to completely deplete the solution of the species of interest that's giving us Faradaic current. So this wouldn't go to zero, as is shown here, and the I capacitive wouldn't go to zero either. But they would come down to some value much, much less than they were at the very beginning. Now, if we... So I have my little animation going on here. Okay, so I Faraday decreases because aux is used up at the electrode surface, and we have to diffuse more material to the electrode surface to replenish it, and then I capacitive drops off as the layer, as the charging becomes more complete. It doesn't go completely to zero, but it does drop off. Here's a little equation, just an exponential decay equation for capacitive current, and you know, we don't know what K is. K is the constant in that exponential decay. But T is time, and so I capacitive drops off with time exponentially. Now, it says here in the red box, because the capacitive current drops off more rapidly than the Faradaic current, drops off with this exponential decay, we can look at the ratio of the Faradaic to capacitive current, and that ratio actually increases. Although both currents are decreasing, the capacitive current is decreasing faster. Therefore, if I take a ratio of the I Faradaic to I capacitive at some time greater than zero, at times greater than zero, that ratio gets larger. Okay, and this is the first, I guess, epiphany of electrochemists who said, aha, because that's what people say when they come up with discoveries, right? Aha! The capacitive current drops off more quickly, and therefore, and that's that non-ideal, bad current, we don't like it, you know, and down with capacitive current. And so if we wait longer times, we can get a better measure of Faradaic current in the presence of capacitive current. And so this is the first, and this theme is going to come up, because the idea, I wouldn't say the holy grail of electrochemistry, but one of the long standing quests in electrochemistry is measure Faradaic current with a minimum contribution of capacitive current. And remember I said before the detection limits occur where you can't distinguish the two, where capacitive and Faradaic current are equal, okay, and I don't know what capacitive current is. So how do we know they're equal? Well, theoretically speaking, where the two are equal, I begin to reach a point where I reach a detection limit. Okay, I can't distinguish one from the other because I don't know what the capacitive current is. So we have this situation, and this is going to become a theme for the next several lectures and in the different techniques that we talk about getting rid of capacitive current or minimizing capacitive current and maximizing measurement of Faradaic current. My statement at the top says the chronoamperometric experiment, chronoamperometry gives us a curve that looks sort of like a Cottrell decay. It is a Cottrell decay with the exponential decay superimposed on it. But the two things that make the curve differ from the Cottrell equation are one, capacitive current, and two, any coupled chemical reactions. Anything funny going on in there in terms of the chemistry. If it's just aux going to red, simple. Okay, that's basic Cottrell equation stuff. But if aux goes to red and then red does something like reacts rapidly with some rapid kinetics, and then maybe there's another chemical reaction going on that's electrochemical, that's an actual reduction process, then the shape of the curve changes, and people can say, aha. They can say that again, okay? They can say, aha, something else is going on in here. There's some complicated chemistry. I can write another paper, okay? I can put another student on this project, and another master's thesis or PhD dissertation will come out of it. So in the old days, when they first started to do electrochemistry, this was the way in which they determined that there was some complicated chemistry going on, and they could analyze the shape of the curve and determine that there was, you know, this complex chemistry. So, applications of chronoamperometry. I got to watch where I write here. We can measure concentration by measuring the current versus concentration. So in other words, Cottrell equation has I on the left-hand side equals a whole bunch of stuff, which generally speaking is constant except for time. In other words, I set up a system and I've got a fixed electrode area and I know what N is because that's intrinsic to the system that I'm analyzing. And all these various, you know, Faraday's constant and so forth. But then there's concentration, the diffusion coefficient, fixed. But concentration of the species and time are two variables in the system. Well, I can figure out what the concentration is if I make a measurement of current at fixed time. So I got a curve, but I'll pick a time out and I'll say, okay, after 10 seconds, I'll make a measurement of current. And if I put a standard in there, a known standard, 10 part per million standard of, let's reduce cadmium today. We'll reduce cadmium at the electrode, and we'll make a measurement of the current at time 10 seconds, and I'll be able to measure the 10 ppm standard, get a current for that, measure an unknown sample based on the current, figure that out. Now, of course, we do more than a one-point calibration curve, but you know, one-point calibration curve, that's unheard of. I do several standards, various concentrations, and then I'd plot a curve, and then I would do my unknown and measure the current, or pick the current value off of the calibration curve and determine the concentration. Now, if I determined that the concentration, that there was a significant error due to capacitive current, then I might go to longer times to minimize that. But either way, I would be able to do, in the first bullet here, I would be able to measure concentration with a chronoamperometric experiment, and I could do analytical chemistry that way. I could also analyze the shape of the current time curve to see if there's any coupled chemical reactions. If it's a nice, you know, today we would, if we were doing this experiment today, we would electrolyze the solution, do the experiment, see this nice curve, and probably fit the Cottrell equation by nonlinear regression or some sophisticated technique like that, and determine what the contribution due to capacitive current is. I'd fit an exponential combined with the Cottrell equation, and we'd analyze the curve, and we'd see if there's anything funny going on. Then that would mean that there were coupled chemical reactions in here. Now, there are better ways to do both of these things. Okay, but I'm teaching you, I'm going over these experiments because, again, people have problems sometimes with electrochemistry, confusion, so we're taking baby steps. All right, we started out with controlled potential electrolysis, and now we're doing chronoamperometry. Do you know that the chronoamperometry experiment is just a variation on controlled potential electrolysis, because all we're doing is the same experiment. Previously, we didn't even measure the current in the controlled potential electrolysis experiment. We either weighed the amount of material plated out, or we were doing purification and separation and electrosynthesis or whatever, but we weren't really measuring current, but we were applying a fixed potential. Well, that's what we're doing here. Now, we've graduated to the next step, and that is measure the current in the system and analyze that current time profile. We'll get on to some more advanced versions of this, but it's the same experiment.
All right, so for the first one, you're basically determining the unknown concentration by how fast the node is
moving. In this experiment?
Yeah, in the first one.
This is chronoamperometry. Okay, so, first bullet, right. Not how fast, just at some t. If you look at the Cottrell equation, right, I is the measured parameter, and it varies with concentration and time. Now, it varies also with diffusion coefficient, area of the electrode, etc., N. But those things, if I set up an electrochemical cell and I select a system, and I said this morning today's cadmium day. So we're going to do cadmium. Okay, if I pick cadmium, N is 2, okay? The diffusion coefficient of cadmium is fixed, okay? If I set up an electrochemical cell, the electrode area is fixed. So the only thing that is in my little cell, my little beaker, that's possible to vary is I could put different concentrations in there and I could wait different amounts of time to measure the current. So I'm going to do the experiment, measure current, and select a time, some t, at which I will then relate I to C.
What about for the unknown, though, you wouldn't know the diffusion coefficient, would you?
No, I'm assuming that I'm measuring cadmium today.
Oh, you're
because
saying.
So I said, when I say it's an unknown concentration. It's not an unknown species. Oh. We'll deal with those kinds of things later on.
Okay, and for the second one, the second bullet, you would tell it would be a chemical reaction because it won't be Cottrell-like.
Right. It will not give you a nice Cottrell type of curve. For example, I versus T, instead of coming down like this, okay, might do something really weird, like it might, you know, come up in here, or it might drop down more rapidly. Okay, it wouldn't give you a normal Cottrell looking curve, and it might even be you might even see a peak come out later in that curve. But we'll talk about that later when we talk about cyclic voltammetry. But I'm jumping ahead. Okay, so chronoamperometry is important because it's a fundamental method on which these other techniques are based. And I said controlled potential electrolysis, chronoamperometry is just a special case of controlled potential electrolysis. And we're really doing both at the same time. Okay, so now chronopotentiometry, all right? I thought we were done with potentiometry. I thought we were doing voltammetry. Okay, this falls under voltammetric techniques because it's an electrolytic cell. We're applying a potential and we're forcing the electrochemical reaction to occur. Just like I said previously, it's chrono, meaning time. It's potential that we're measuring, okay? And we're measuring, okay? So it's in that sense, we are going to measure potential. So that's what this tells you. Okay, do you have this? Everybody's flipping. I don't know. Some people aren't flipping. So chronopotentiometry is another technique, but it's a little bit different. Now, it's a stationary electrode again. It's unstirred, mass transport by diffusion. Here's the key difference. It's constant current. This is one of two techniques that are constant current techniques, okay? And the constant current is applied between the electrodes with a device called the galvanostat. I haven't said anything about this. This triggers something in my brain. On the website, okay, if you can find the notes for class, is that my notes there?
No.
That looks like a snowstorm, but no. At any rate, on the website on the far right hand side are handouts, okay? PDF files. You click on those PDF files, and there are some handouts there. Handouts, you know, this is a euphemism for, you know, I'm not handing anything out, okay? You're required to go and look at those things. You don't have to print them out if you don't want to. You can look at them online. But the point is that there's one of them talks about a galvanostat. It's got a weird picture of an octopus on the cover. And it talks about a galvanostat. Now, those handout materials are written at a technical level, but not at a high level of electrochemistry. In other words, you don't have to be an electrochemist to read that stuff. As a matter of fact, one of the handouts in the voltammetry section is electrochemistry for non-electrochemists. You say, oh, yeah, I'm cool with that, yeah. Okay, not electrochemistry for poets, but electrochemistry for non-electrochemists, for technical people. And so where I've gotten a lot of these things is out of trade journals, you know, Chemical and Engineering News. You know, it's for technical people, but you may not be a practitioner in the field, so they kind of boil it down to the basics. So look at those handout materials, okay? There's good information there, and generally speaking, they're not long. They're 2, 3, maybe 4 pages long.
12, 11.
There might be a couple that are 12 or 11 pages. But generally speaking, they're only a few pages, and they'll give you another perspective, another explanation. If you say, well, I don't know what he's talking about. You know, he's always babbling about something, you know, and I'm trying to get sleep, and, you know, I'm sleep deprived. But take a look at those, and you'll get another perspective, another explanation of what's going on. A galvanostat is a device. It's an electronic device that will supply constant current. It is, I mentioned to you before, potentiostat. It's uncommon, although possible, to build the function of a galvanostat into a potentiostat. And if you saw the classical potentiostats, like the ones I have downstairs, they have like 50 knobs on the front of the thing, you know, dials, knobs, you know, all kinds of stuff. And you say, like, what do you do with all that stuff? What do you do with all those dials and knobs? Well, some of them, they're all for different parameters in the electrochemical experiment. But the point is, this device does many experiments, many electrochemical experiments, and this one is the constant current experiment, and you need a device that has the capability of being a galvanostat, providing a steady, constant current to the system. We're going to measure potential versus time, as we stated from the name of the technique, and as we apply constant current, we're going to measure potential versus time. The system is basically the same as we saw before. Ox to red, ox and red are soluble, reversible reaction from an electrochemical standpoint. And then we say here we apply the current, we use up ox at the electrode surface, and we produce red. All right. So this is basically the same as what we've done before. The only difference now is I've taken one more baby step up here, and that is we are going to use a constant current mode of operation. Now, this is a diagram we've seen before, right? When we talked about, what did I call it? Concentration polarization. Okay, polarization. We use this diagram to describe the fact that if I have a species ox at the beginning, has this concentration right across the top, and I begin to electrolyze the solution. I'm still electrolyzing the solution, although I'm doing it with constant current. I drop ox down to zero, okay, at the electrode surface, and it begins to diffuse to the surface from distances further and further away. As we increase the time, we polarize the solution more and more. At the same time, red is being produced at the electrode surface. Its concentration jumps way up to a high value, okay? And then as we get further away from the electrode surface, distance from the electrode surface, the concentration of red drops off. So here's my reaction. Apply a current to use up ox. In other words, it goes to zero at the electrode surface while I'm producing red. The theory of chronopotentiometry is wrapped up in the Nernst equation again. Okay, Nernst equation keeps coming up. So sooner or later, you're going to have to memorize. Sooner or later, by default, you'll have memorized. You'll be Nernst equation in your sleep. Nothing to it. Here's what happens. The Nernst equation applies here, but we're not controlling things based on the Nernst equation. We are not giving an E applied anymore. I said to you before, in this area of electrochemistry, typically we're applying a certain E value, a certain potential, and we're looking at concentrations that are produced or depleted in this experiment. But here, the Nernst equation is going to work for us. We're going to use it. But we're not going to control things based on the Nernst equation because we're controlling the current. We're providing a constant current. What happens is I apply a current, okay, the system, and I'll show you a diagram of this in a minute, but I'll talk in terms of the diagram, and maybe that picture will help you understand what's going on. I have a system, and going to measure potential, okay, E, versus time in the system. and I'm applying some constant current to the system, and as I move along, as I go through the experiment, I probably maybe I shouldn't draw the diagram yet. As I go along in the system, E gradually changes because the system is trying to maintain the current. In other words, as I pump current into the system, I've got to have some process that uses the current. The current's got to go somewhere, right? It's got to go. Those electrons that I want to flow into the system have to go somewhere. So what happens is E is allowed to change. The potential in the system is allowed to change until it finds a value at which an electrochemical reaction is occurring. So E gradually changes until we reach a point where the we have ox going to red, and it says red goes up and ox goes down, right? I could write it on here, I guess. I got plenty of space. The reaction is ox plus n electrons yields red. Okay, so a gradual change in E occurs as red goes up. So this is increasing and this is decreasing. All right, from the Nernst equation, red is going up, ox is going down. Right, so that means the log of that is changing, and this is constant, and this is constant, and this is constant. Okay, so we don't have to worry about that whole mess. So the E applied is going to change as I convert ox to red in my system. Okay. Ultimately, the surface concentration of ox goes to zero. And to sustain that, to maintain a concentration of ox, to keep that current going, okay, that's being applied to the system, the electrode potential begins to make a change. It has to change in order to continue to take up the current that's being applied. And so that continues to go on until a point at which all of the ox in the system that can handle the current has been converted to red, and I've got to go to, then I move on to some other potential where another species will be converted. Okay, so this is what's going to go on. And now I'll use this diagram. I won't bother. I got it on the slide. Why draw it? Okay, so chronopotentiometry. Here's our output wave, or output, whatever you want to call it, output curve. E versus time. And at the start, there's no red present, and E is not defined in this system. But as I try to maintain the current, the high current level, or whatever the current level happens to be that I'm flowing into the system, the E goes up to find a value at which ox will go to red. I think, let's see. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So what happens is, it's some through a range of values of time, the E is governing, or the E that we observe, the E that we measure, is just due to this ox-red couple, okay? Ox being converted to red, ox is going down, red is going up. Remember I told you before, E in the Nernst equation is equal to E0, and then there's this fudge factor added on. That's the really ugly part of the Nernst equation, okay? E is around the E0. It's in the neighborhood of the E0, but it's adjusted by the constant, by that right hand, that whole big mess on the right hand side of the Nernst equation, because ox and red are changing, and then therefore the log of ox and red are changing, and therefore that influences the E, modifies it from the E0 that we observe. So all through this transition time, E is around the E0. It changes a little bit, and you notice it more prominent at the ends of that transition time, but because that's where you get the extremes in concentration of, in this case, ox's highest. Okay, ox is high here, and red is high over here. in this region of it. And so that term on the right-hand side gets changed in the Nernst equation, gets changed most, but in between, it's just a little correction on RE0. Okay? Once ox is used up, and there's no more or not enough ox coming to the electrode surface to maintain the current, the potential shoots up. E goes up to find the next thing that's going to reduce. Okay? What's the next thing that's going to reduce? What else is in their system that will allow the current to be maintained and the current to be satisfied in this coronal potentiometry system? Okay, so that's what's going on. The transition time turns out to be related to how much ox we have in the system. So we have this equation down here, known as the sand equation. Okay, the sand equation says tau to the 1/2 power, in other words, the square root of tau, this transition time, okay, is equal to pi to the 1/2 NFAD. D is also to the 1/2 power. Looks familiar, right? But these are all constants. The things of importance are the concentration of ox and I. Now, think with me here. If I is large, the transition time is going to be small, right? The more current I pump into the system, the faster I convert ox to red. So if I increase I, T gets smaller, tau gets smaller. So that makes sense. It's in the numerator. No, it's in the denominator. It's in the bottom, okay? Numerator, denominator. It's in the bottom of the equation. It's inversely proportional. Tau is inversely proportional by the square root. Yes?
What unit
is tau in? Time.
Yeah, but...
Square root of time?
It doesn't matter.
Really depends on... typically, it would be seconds, okay? But it really depends on the levels. If you're working at really small concentrations, it's going to be seconds. If it's molar concentrations, it might be minutes. But in those kinds of areas, for a typical laboratory setup. Now, tau also is going to be affected. The transition time is going to be affected by how much ox we have. If we got lots of ox, it's going to take a while to get through that transition region. All right, if we have small amounts of ox, tau is going to be smaller. So this is logical, all right, and we can understand what's going on. And again, these are conceptually, I'm giving you these techniques, these different ways of doing electrochemistry in order for you to understand the concepts of what happens when I monkey with a current? What happens when I monkey with the potential? What happens when I change the potential, scan the potential? We're getting to that. Don't ask that question yet. We're getting there. Okay. So this is coronal potentiometry, and the sand equation is the equation that governs coronal potentiometry. Quick summary of coronal potentiometry. Quantitative analysis can be done by relating tau to the 1/2 power to the concentration of ox. It's better done by other methods. This is a little bit tough to handle sometimes, but so there are other ways that are better of doing this, but it does illustrate for us a constant current situation in electrochemistry and what would happen if we are pumping electrons in there at a constant flow of electrons. Chronopotentiometry is really lousy at dealing with capacitive current. It doesn't in any way reduce, limit, or allow us to determine Faradaic current in the presence of capacitive current in any good way. Okay, it doesn't help us with that problem at all. Okay, so for that one reason alone, and the problem that's a little bit tough to handle, you start the experiment, before you know it, it's over. It's a little bit tough to handle chronopotentiometry, and you don't see people doing much chronopotentiometry today. Now, this is going to be called technique a minute, I think, when we get going here in electrochemistry. We're moving on. So we talked about chronoamperometry today. We talked a little bit about last class. We talked about chronopotentiometry today. Now we're going to talk about coulometry. I don't know if I want to lay this on you too heavy stuff here right now, but I said to you already, controlled potential electrolysis, fixed electrode potential, and then we measured weight or we just used it to do something. Then I gave you the special case of controlled potential electrolysis, which was chronoamperometry, where we held the potential fixed again, okay, still controlled potential electrolysis, but we're measuring the current versus time, so it became chrono, time, amperometry, current. Now I'm going to do coulometry, okay, and it's the same experiment again, only now I'm going to use some advanced mathematics, okay, and I'm going to integrate under the curve, okay, I'm going to integrate under the current time curve. So coulometry is the field or the sub-discipline of electrochemistry where we count coulombs, where we count charge, where we measure the charge or integrate the charge that is used to convert one species to another, ox to red, if you like my usual way of doing things. It follows Faraday's law, which is older than the hills, okay? I mean, older than dirt. I mean, Faraday's been dead for hundreds of years now, okay? And but he came up with this relationship, and it's a very simple relationship. It says that the weight of a species, okay, the number of grams that is produced, okay, is related to the charge, okay, electrical charge. Now the units are coulombs, but the symbol is Q, just like the symbol for potential is E, but the units are volts. Okay, so Q is the charge, and M is the molecular weight. So, and I told you before, the Faraday's constant is just a mole of electrons or mole of charge, or the amount of charge that's needed to convert a mole of a species. So that's all we're doing here is we're multiplying the charge times the molecular weight. All right. Then we divide that by the number of electrons in the system and Faraday's constant. Now, if you take the units of all of these things, N is unitless, okay, so there's no units on N. Faraday's constant is in coulombs per mole, right? So we put that down here. We got molecular weight, which is the number of grams in a mole of that particular substance. If you take all those units and plug them into this equation, you know, coulombs here, grams per mole, so it's coulombs, grams per mole, but down here we got coulombs per mole, so the coulombs and moles cancel, and we end up with grams, right? So the units all work out. So it's a very simple relationship that tells us the weight of a material, knowing its molecular weight and number of electrons that are used in the conversion from one form to the other, and the amount of charge that we measure relates that to the weight of the species that's produced or used up, depending on the type of experiment you're doing. So that's coulometry. Now, there are two kinds of coulometry, of course. Why not six kinds? But the fundamental assumption that is a good assumption, but is adhered to in coulometry, is that the reaction is 100% current efficient. 100% current efficient. Now, what does that mean? It means that all of the electrons that are pumped into the system go to convert the species that we're interested in. Ox converted to red. There is no loss of electrons due to, I don't know, waste. Some leaked out of the beaker. Oh, some electrons leaked out. Okay. Electrons don't leak out of the sockets here. Okay, when we're not around, there's no puddle of electrons on the floor. All right, so the current that is supplied to the system converts one species to the other, and we're assuming 100% current efficiency. Now you stop if you have your thinking caps on. I know it's early, but if you think about it, you say, well, wait a minute. You told us before that there's capacitive current, and some energy is being used to migrate ions to the electrode surface. So that's going to be an error. That's true. Normally, the way we deal with that error is we do the coulometry for a sufficient amount of time such that the current used to convert ox to red or whatever the species is that you're dealing with is sufficiently large that it's much bigger than the capacitive current. And therefore, the capacitive current is a very tiny error in the experiment. All right, so if we have to do is make I Faradaic, you know, my rule of thumb, 1%. If I can do things within 1%, I'm doing all right. I'm doing pretty good usually. So if I do, and I could even do better, I could do 0.1%. So as long as I make sure that my current that I'm integrating in this system that I'm measuring over time, and integrating current the current time curve, as long as I make sure that that's 100 times, 1,000 times larger than my Faradaic current, I'll be fine. The assumption will be met within 0.1% or 1% or whatever criterion you use. That's the kind of way you got to think as an analytical chemist. If the boss only wants the result, plus or minus, if he says, just give me a rough idea of what's in the sample, don't do your best analytical work, okay? Do what's necessary, maybe a little better than what he wants, in order to get the job done in a sufficient amount of time. And he'll be happy that you got the answer in there quick and got him the result quick, and he'll say, go ahead, knock off early today. Go home 5 minutes early. At any rate, there are two kinds of coulometry. One is the controlled potential. That's the kind that's controlled potential electrolysis. It's a subset of controlled potential electrolysis. We're electrolyzing at a fixed potential. It's a subset because we're, as chronoamperometry was, we were measuring current. Well, we're measuring current here, but we're actually integrating the current over time, and so it becomes coulometry. We're actually doing three experiments at the same time. The old guys, Michael Faraday and them, they didn't quite have this figured out yet because they didn't have the modern instrumentation that we have in order to do three experiments at one time. They could only do one thing at once. All right? No walking and chewing gum at the same time. So here we have the charge in the system is just the integration over time of the current. So the Cottrell equation curve, I guess I could draw that here, of current. Let's see, I use lowercase I here. Okay? You got to watch me. I'm switching all the time. Versus time, the Cottrell equation, all we're doing is we're integrating the curve. Okay? We're integrating the area under the curve. All right? Nothing more. Okay, so it's like chronoamperometry. It's a subset of controlled potential electrolysis. It can be referred to, it's sometimes referred to as chronocoulometry. Now, I'm throwing a lot of words around here, but they're simple. Chrono, time, coulometry, integrating the current time curve. Usually it's called chronocoulometry if I decide I'm going to integrate for a fixed amount of time. Remember the thing I did before when I said we were doing chronoamperometry? I picked time, like 10 seconds, and I measure the current at 10 seconds. Well, in chronocoulometry, I pick a time and say, okay, I'm only going to integrate for 10 seconds because I'm in a hurry. Okay, so I got places to go, people to see, things to do, and so I am going to only integrate for a fixed amount of time, and it becomes chronocoulometry rather than allowing the experiment to go on until the current drops off to next to zero, and I'm integrating the entire area under the entire curve. I'm just going to do it for a fixed amount of time. Okay, so that's controlled potential coulometry. The other kind of coulometry is the second case of a constant current technique. Okay, we apply a constant current. And if integrals scare you, oh, then just do this. Okay, because even I can figure this out. Okay, if I have fixed current, okay, if the current is constant, okay, and I can measure time, I only wish my cell phone would measure seconds. Okay, I could use it as a stopwatch. But at any rate, I can measure time. My instrument is using a galvanostat. I'm applying a fixed current. I times T, okay, and we've got charge. Okay, we've got very simple system. So it's another example of a constant current technique, but as it states here, it's not really used that much anymore. A little difficult to do. That assumption that we have 100% current efficiency, remember what happened in chronopotentiometry at the end of the curve, the potential takes off until it finds a potential where I can reduce some other species that might be present in the system.
When you say there's enough stuff to characterize an electric circuit,
no, because the current is actually occurs. Remember, this isn't, there's no black magic involved here. It's strictly whatever reaches the electrode surface is oxidized or reduced, depending on what you're doing. And that current, okay, from that electrochemical process, the current, okay, is generated. And so if I'm, in the case of constant current systems, I am forcing current into the system, so I have to have enough stuff at the electrode surface to carry that charge. If, in the, as we know from the Cottrell equation and the whole diffusion-controlled concentration polarization curve that I showed you, if I deplete the solution near the electrode, you know, things are diffusing, but there's not enough stuff there to be to carry the current that I'm forcing into the system, then the potential is going to migrate to some other level, to some other value where it can find something else to electrolyze. It may electrolyze my solvent. Okay, maybe the only other thing in there that I can electrolyze. Okay, when we do coulometry, probably the single biggest application is in coulometric titrations. And here, the most common permutation that I've seen of a coulometric titration is one where you have a species that's unstable, and you want to produce that species. And coulometry has a lot of advantages here. Number one, I can produce the titrant in situ, or in situ if you prefer. Okay, I can produce it right in my reaction vessel. So I can make the titrant right on the spot. Well, if it's unstable, that's great. I make it, use it, great. Don't have to worry about, oh, it was on the shelf, gee, it's old, I gotta order some more, I gotta dispose of the old stuff, got problems here. I generate it and I use it right on the spot, so that's great. Secondly, okay, the other advantage is while I'm making the titrant, I'm standardizing it at the same time. Or in other words, I'm using a coulometric process to control how much titrant I have. And here's how it works. I go to the shelf, and I want to do a titration with bromine. Okay, that's my titrant. But bromine is unstable. Okay, and I could order some bromine water to use as a titrant, but then I'd probably have to standardize it when it got here and wait for it to come, and then every time I use it, I got to standardize it and so forth. So what I do is I go to the shelf and I find a bromide salt, potassium bromide, sodium bromide, whatever, and I make a solution of that. What concentration? It don't matter. Okay, just slopping things around, a pinch of this, you know, a spoonful of that. As long as there's enough bromide in there, I'll be okay. Then I do my coulometric experiment, counting the coulombs that I use to convert the bromide to bromine. All right. So I do the coulometry, convert the bromide to bromine, and because I know how many coulombs it used to do that conversion, I know exactly from Faraday's law how much bromine I have. So I generated the bromine, okay, and I standardized it at the same time. I know exactly what it is, and now I can use it as a titrant in my experiment. So useful for titrants that can't be stored as stable solutions. We can measure small currents quite accurately, so we can make even dilute solutions, and that happens. That's an advantage if the stuff is kind of reactive and causes a problem that way. Dilute solutions are going to be a little bit more stable. And then, in theory, I can count the coulombs for any method where current is measured. Well, okay, so this is just a general statement about coulometry. Anytime I measure current, I could integrate the current time curve and measure coulombs. And in a lot of cases, that can be a little more accurate. Okay, especially if, just like when we do radioactive experiments with radioactivity. Okay, we prefer to use less radioactivity than more radioactivity, right? We want to keep the levels low. So what do? We typically integrate the number of disintegrations per second. We do an integration, or we count the number of integrations per second. Well, that's sort of what we're doing here. We're counting the coulombs. Later in the course, we'll talk about counting photons. It's always more accurate to count at low levels to rather than measure a steady state value, steady state current, steady state number of photons, steady state number of disintegrations for a radiochemical process. It's always better to count the number and just sum that number up or integrate that number rather at low levels than it is to try to count the steady state value. So in low levels, it's better to count coulombs. So I can do that with any technique that I have, current versus time. All right, I have a little example on the next slide of a setup I just borrowed from a book. Here's a coulometric cell. It's just a round bottom flask, a little stir bar in there, three neck flask. It happens to have, this particular system happens to have two sets of electrodes. This set of electrodes and this, they go into the vessel over here, go to a constant current coulometric power supply. Now, this guy's in a hurry. So what he does is he says, okay, if I'm going to generate this stuff, I'm just going to say one millivolt over 10 seconds. Punches that into his little digital galvanostat, presses the button, and the system does the experiment for him. Applies the current, okay? I meant 1 milliamp. 1 milliamp is current, right? We're dealing with current. You got to correct me if I make mistakes. 1 milliamp applied for some time. So I sets it up, presses the button, and it does the experiment. It applies that current to those electrodes and generates just the amount of bromine that's necessary. This is a bromine reaction where I'm going to create. I'm going to do a add bromine. I'm gonna brominate cyclohexane, it says here. Got to read the. I want you to read these slides, okay? Just because I don't read them doesn't mean you don't have to. I've read them before, okay? But you need to read these slides. So it's just a bromination of the cyclohexane. So I generate the bromine in the vessel, okay? And then I do my coulometric titration. Now this is. This is just this part of the system is there to generate the titrant, and then this part of the system is to measure an amperometric endpoint for the system. Okay, so I generate bromine in the system, and in this particular case, I actually add the cyclohexane and allow it to react to be brominated. Okay, and so here's the reactions that are going on. This reaction is going on over here. This reaction is measured here. And then we have a system, just like we talked about before, same kind of a system I diagrammed for you in the chrono, when I talked about three electrode systems and the chrono, I didn't know it wasn't chrono, it was controlled potential electrolysis. We're measuring voltage, okay? We got current and voltage being measured in our particular system here as we go through our amperometric experiment. All right, so that's just an example of this coulometry. Here's some more, okay? I forgot about this. Okay, I got a table of examples of coulometric titrations. The big E, where is the big E? Right here is the big E right here. Not the big E, okay? Not to be confused with the big E in West Springfield, Massachusetts, okay? But this is the big E, okay? This is the Carl Fisher. Anybody do Carl Fisher titrations? Okay, so they don't use pyridine anymore, do they? Oh, they still use pyridine? Oh, how disgusting. Pyridine stinks.
Doesn't it also cause Michael's error?
Yes. Yes, it does. So it's a problem, okay? Pyridine, lutidine, okay, all of those nasty things. But the idea of a Carl Fisher titration is we're looking for water, okay, or we're titrating, coulometrically titrating water. The reagent is an iodine system, and very commonly used. It's really the only good way to measure water in pharmaceutical preparations or whatever. Lots of other examples of coulometric systems, specific applications, okay, special applications. At Bristol-Myers, we did non-aqueous, we did non-aqueous coulometric titrations of penicillin substitutes like V-cillin K and things like that. And this was a finished product titration, but lots of different things can be done this way. But titrations, who does titrations anymore? Okay, titrations are, if we can come up with another way of doing things, we don't do titrations. But when you have to, still very good way of doing the experiment. Before I move on to voltammetry, any questions about what we've talked about? We're all really cool with this stuff. This is no problem. Okay, great. Now, I got this thing here, voltammetry, and you said, wait a minute, I thought we'd been talking about voltammetry. Well, we have been in the very broad sense. Specifically, we talked about controlled potential electrolysis, chronoamperometry, chronopotentiometry, and two kinds of coulometry. All right. Now we're moving on to I didn't mention chronocoulometry, but they're all in there, okay? Now we're going to talk about the specific experiment known as voltammetry, and there are going to be, again, two major variations and about 50 minor variations, okay? So the major variations are really going to be around whether we stir or we don't stir. To stir or not to stir? That is the question. The resultant curve that we get, whether we stir or don't stir, is going to be quite different. I'll tell you that right up front. Simple experimental setup is still a stationary electrode, so we stick the electrode. Of course, it's probably a three-electrode system, but the working electrode is a stationary electrode. In this particular case, we're going to stir. Now, so that means it's a convective mass transport system. We could also rotate the electrode if we wanted to, but that adds some even further complications. So I'm not going to keep this simple and for us to understand the concepts of electrochemistry, I'm going to keep it simple. I'm going to use a stationary electrode, but I'm going to stir the solution and get things to the solution by convective mass transport. We will be varying the potential linearly with time, and we've seen that before. It's E versus time is just a linear ramp. Okay, so I'm applying the potential, but I'm scanning the potential to let's say I'm going to do a reduction. I start at some more positive value, and I scan in a negative direction to more and more reducing conditions. That's usually the case, particularly if I'm going to reduce ox to red. Both ox and red are soluble. It's a reversible chemical, electrochemically reversible reaction. Okay, and I don't know. Potential varies. I guess that's obvious. All right? The potential varies, and usually we measure current. Okay, and in reality, it's current versus time, but time and potential vary. So our plot, our ultimate plot, is actually going to be current versus potential. Okay, and here we go. There it is: current versus potential. Current versus potential. Okay. The curve for voltammetry in a stirred solution looks like this. Okay. Did I show you a curve like that before? I showed you something like this before. I said you go along, nothing's happening. You know, the potential's not sufficient. Then you get to a place where the potential is sufficient. Before we jumped it really fast and jumped right up to some value where the reaction was occurring. Okay, we're going to draw that out a little bit, and we're going to scan the potential a little bit slower so we can analyze this curve. But this is a very typical curve for voltammetry in a stirred solution. The final value of the current up in this region here is referred to as the limiting current. Okay, the limiting current is up in here. Limiting current, steady state current, when the oxidized form of this couple, ox red couple, has gone to zero at the electrode surface. Down here, ox is a maximum and red is a zero, right? Because we haven't reached the potential at which they occur. In here, there's varying amounts of each. Okay? Out here, we've gotten to sufficient potentials where all of ox is immediately converted to the species red. As soon as it touches the electrode surface, it gets converted. Okay? So, define limiting current steady state when ox is in the electrode surface. The applied potential is sufficiently cathodic such that all ox is reduced at the electrode surface. That's the case out in this region, the limiting current region. Now, the reality of it is, let me just take a peek at the next slide. Oh, okay. So I've got a couple of equations for you. Here's my explanation of what's going on here. There's two, maybe three regions in this, two important regions, one boring region, okay, in this curve. The boring region is up here, right? Because this is boring because nothing's happening, right? I'm applying a potential, but it's insufficient to do anything. So the potential is too positive to cause the reduction of ox to red. So that's boring. But I continue to increment the, you know, E is varying versus time. E is increasing versus time. E versus time. Okay, I continue to vary E with time, and I get to a region where it does begin to convert ox to red. But the ox concentration is really high, okay, and that's in the denominator, and the red concentration is really low, okay, that's in the numerator, and I'm just beginning to see a little bit of current produced because of that. Now, this is all according to the Nernst equation, so I threw the Nernst equation down here to remind you that this is controlling the process. This is the Nernst-controlled current in this area. So I continue to vary the potential. E applied is changing, okay? Then therefore, ox and red concentrations have to change, right? Because this E applied is changing. This is a constant, this is a constant, this is a constant, this is a constant, this is a constant. This is a constant. Okay, these are all constants, okay? This part of the equation doesn't do anything for me. Well, it does, but it does the same thing for me all the time. And what's varying is the ox-red ratio based on the E that I apply in my system. E is varying with time, so the ox and red are changing. And as they change, I see a current being produced. I get into a region where lots of red is being produced from ox, and the current goes up quite large. Now, it's all at the electrode surface, and we haven't even gotten to the point where all of the ox is used up at the electrode surface. The minute, though, I use some of it, I begin to get diffusion of species from the bulk solution to the electrode surface because some of the ox has been converted to red, and so the concentration at the electrode surface has decreased a little bit. Not all the way to zero, as in some of our diagrams, but a little bit. And so stuff is still coming to the electrode surface. I continue to scan my potential with time. It gets more and more negative, more and more reducing, more and more of the ox at the surface of the electrode is converted to red. Okay, and at some point, and I probably make this more like a gray area than a point. Okay, at some point, we could make it a big fat line. Yeah, this is the way I used to color when I was in grade school. Okay, some region in there, I convert from a Nernstian-controlled region of the experiment to a, we don't have a name for this equation, this equation-controlled region of the experiment, okay? Because this is our convective mass transport equation that we talked about previously, okay? In this region, remember, it's stirring, okay? It's stirring. Okay, but moving stuff up to the diffusion layer, okay, pretty rapidly. But then it has to diffuse across that layer. And that's what I was talking about before when I said it's diffusing in to replace the amount of ox that was produced. Here, somewhere in here, I satisfied the Nernst equation to the point where every bit, the E that I'm applying, would convert every single bit of ox that hits the electrode surface to red. Okay, I've gone beyond, and by the way, every potential, every E value greater than that, more negative than that, will convert all the ox to red.
What yes. Can you tell or can you tell when red equals
ox? Oh, that's easy.
Well, when it equals enough.
What's that? When it equals it enough? Huh?
No, when E equals enough.
E naught. Okay. Well, halfway. Halfway. We'll talk. We'll define probably next class. When based on current, we'll do a thing for limiting current. It's halfway to the limiting current. Okay, yep.
It's basically you're measuring current, mm-hmm. which is related to the potential, which is created from concentration of reducing oxidized species.
The potential is applied. We're in control. You control the horizontal. You control the vertical. Okay. You control the potential applied to the system. So you set the scan rate. You say, okay, I'm going to start at a value of, let's say I start at a value of negative 0.5 volts, okay, or 500 millivolts, same thing, and I'm going to scan to a negative 900 millivolts, okay, I'm going to scan that 400 millivolt region, and I'm going to do it at a scan rate of 50 millivolts a second. Okay, so you control this, you dial this into your instrument. Okay, nowadays it's you go to a computer screen and you fill in the blanks. Okay, and that's how it's done. But in the old days, you flip the knobs. We still do that. We still have potentiostats that work that way. You set the scan rate of the applied potential and the ramp and and so forth, and then you measure the current that's produced as the system scans along and follows, and I'm telling you, according to theory, according to what we know about the Nernst equation and about the convective mass transport equation, what the curve is, what the experiment is doing, why the output curve looks like it looks, because of the theoretical considerations that we know. Does that make sense? Not completely, huh? You stare at it long enough, it'll sink in. Go home.
So basically, with that equation right there, you measure the current and you can measure your concentration.
Okay. What we're going to end up doing, we'll get to that, but the limiting current is going to be the thing that we pick off for quantitative analysis. That's probably on one of my next slides. I want to do quantitative analysis. I want to know how much stuff is in there. This is going to be the easiest thing for me to measure. I just say, okay, limiting current, that value of current is that's going to relate to my concentration. Okay. Now you say, well, then why bother doing the whole experiment? Why bother scanning along if all you're going to do is measure this? Because you asked the question before, how do we know what it is? How do we know what the stuff is? If I just set the value of E out here and reduced everything that was possible to reduce at that potential, I wouldn't know what I was reducing. I'd reduce everything that was in this. It might be four or five things in there that are all reducing. So I do this experiment, and I scan along, and the potential, the current, rises at particular values of a potential. Why? You asked the question a minute ago about when the two things are equal. Well, we'll say this is a value characteristic of what? It's characteristic of E0. And E0, we can read off of we can go to a table and say, oh, standard reduction potential for cadmium is 0.64 volts. I don't know what it is.
So you'd see a little plateau.
Well, you see, this is what you see, okay? What you see is what you get.
But there's only one species in there?
Okay, this tells me there's only one species in there because there's only one wave.
Right.
Okay, if there were two species in there,
okay,
and this one would be reducing at this potential, okay, because this is an E curve, and this one is over here. Right? Your I'm getting to all of this stuff, but since you're asking the question, I'm answering. I'm getting to all of these things, okay? So the main point I wanted to make here is, first of all, this is the general shape of the curve. And for a stirred system, okay, it's stirred, we get a limiting current up here. It stays sort of constant because we're stirring and shoving stuff from the bulk solution to the electrode surface, and it becomes controlled by our convective mass transport equation. And then down in this region, okay, it's Nernst equation controlled, all right? And that's the take-home message. Oh, okay. So this gives the quantitative information. You asked the question. Oh, why doesn't it say qualitative? Okay, this gives the quantitative, because I haven't gotten there yet, I guess. All right, here we go. So this is the same curve from a book. I like my curve better. My curve was colorful, less complicated. Okay, but at any rate, it's still current versus potential. All right, and I've given it a new name. It's still voltammetry stirred, but it's also linear scan voltammetry. It's linear scan in a stirred solution, so it's a linear scan of E versus time. And what do we got? We've got the curve. It's a little more stand up. The curve stands up more the higher the concentration. And I have the limiting current listed here, where the quantitative information comes from, and the E1/2. You say E1/2, I thought it was an E0. Well, I'm going to define it in a minute. E1/2 is when we're halfway to the limiting current, okay? And halfway to the limiting current voltammetry situations where we're scanning is called E1/2. You say, I thought, shouldn't that be the E0? Well, it should be. We'll relate the two. There's a slight difference between E1/2 and E0. But that's the qualitative information that tells you what the stuff is. Yes, if I had, and again, I'm an inorganic kind of guy, so I've done most of the electrochemistry that I've done is inorganic electrochemistry, in other words, measuring metals. And so if I have a solution that contains copper, cadmium, lead, zinc, okay, maybe even, and a bunch of other things, but those are my favorite metals, you can actually see a wave in this curve for each one of those metals. They all reduce at a different potential, and you see them in the curve. Okay, you see a wave for each one, and if they're all there together, and I think I have a picture of this coming up. Probably. Wow, look at all this stuff. There it is. Okay, if they're all there together, it's one wave stacked on another wave. All right. But don't jump ahead yet. Come on, stop jumping ahead. All right. So. E1/2 is defined as the E when the limiting current, when you're halfway to the limiting current. Okay, so that's what this is. IL is the limiting current. They don't give you that though, huh? IL. And then this is IL over 2. Oh yeah, there it is, IL. Right in front of my face. Okay, so this is for a stirred solution, voltammetry in a stirred solution. Let's see, what else do we got? Oh, okay. That curve was a stand-up curve. This was perfectly flat down here. This is perfectly flat. Then it jumps up. Then it levels off real flat. That's because you're dealing with high concentrations. They don't tell you that, but that's why that curve looks like that. Trust me, after doing electrochemistry for years, that's what the reason for that is. If you do low concentrations, all of a sudden you begin to see the curve stretch out a little bit. And you see that this is a slope. There's a slope down here. What's the slope due to? The slope, of course, is due to I capacitive, which I've now digressed all the way to calling it IC instead of I cap. Okay? They're all the same. Okay, I'm just getting lazier. Okay? Getting lazier with time. So, as we scan, the deal with scanning, the linear scan experiment, as I vary the potential, more and more stuff migrates to the solution, to the surface of the electrode, which generates a capacitive current, which means I've got a constant ramp of charging current in my background. And this is a problem for me doing these experiments because capacitive current doesn't give me any information. It's just an error or a non-ideal current in my experiment, in this background. Now, if I have really high concentrations, like on the previous slide, this is so big that this disappears. Right? Well, who has a problem measuring high concentrations? Listen, it's easy. But when I get down to low concentrations, and this becomes a little bit smaller in magnitude, the magnitude of the current, then I begin to see the I capacitive. And if this gets really small, I can get situations where the capacitive current background, the ramp for the capacitive current in the background is very steep, and my current that I'm measuring, the Faraday current that I'm measuring, is kind of small. And now I'm like, gee, can I really measure that? You know, is that really an accurate number, accurate value? This becomes very steep and very sloped. Okay, so that's capacitive current. That's reality. Here's the limiting current. Here's the halfway potential, halfway to the limiting current. And what else do we have here? Oh, okay. Halfway potential is defined, E one half is defined as E when I is equal to I limiting over 2, IL over 2. That's the definition of the half wave potential. I is proportional to red. IL represents the situation where red is a maximum and aux is 0. What else we got here? When I is equal to IL over 2, then red equals aux. E is equal to E one half, and that is the electrochemical or voltammetric definition of the E one half. Now, E zero, the difference between E one half and E zero. The difference is E zero is a thermodynamic parameter defined for standard conditions. What are standard conditions? Zero ionic strength, 25 degrees C. Okay. In reality, we can't do electrochemistry at zero ionic strength, right? We have to have ions in there. And so it's impossible to do electrochemistry under conditions where I would get a true E0. So I have to do them under conditions where I can actually make the measurement. I've actually got ions in the solution, conducting electrolyte and so forth. Yes? It is defined as a thermodynamic parameter defined for standard conditions. One atmospheric pressure, zero ionic strength, 25 degrees C. Okay, but we can't do our experiment under zero ionic strength conditions. All right, and we may not be at 25 degrees C. So, and actually, if we add ions into the system, the E changes a little bit depending on whether I'm using potassium nitrate, sodium chloride, other things, depending on whether it's 0.1 molar, 0.01 molar. Okay, those all affect it. So E one half values are tabulated for specific electrolytes and for specific conditions. So if I look up an E one half value for cadmium, because today is cadmium day, then for cadmium I find a value. It's going to differ slightly, not a lot, but slightly from the E0 for cadmium. It'll be similar. But it'll be specific for the particular, when I look it up in the table, there'll be several E1 half values for different standard electrolytes that people use. 0.1 molar potassium nitrate is a common one that we find, certain pH values. E1 half will be defined under those conditions. Now, it's the qualitative thing. So I do an experiment, I get a value, okay, and again, we have to worry about our reference electrode too, because unless we're using hydrogen, and that's zero, but we're going to be using like a silver chloride, and that has a 0.222 volt E. So we have to consider all that, then we look up in the table and we say, okay, my value that I got, I did this unknown sample, I had absolutely no idea what the concentration was or what the species was. And I scanned it in voltammetry. It came out with an E one half of whatever. I looked it up in the table, and there's only one thing that could be in there that would give me that E one half. All right? Now, I wouldn't go to court with that data. Okay, I wouldn't go to court with that because they'd find some guy who has a PhD in chemistry and a law degree, and he'd attack you on the stand and say, wait a minute, there could be something else. And what if you had an overpotential? And what if your conditions were a little bit off? And what if you calibrated your potentiostat? And they'd ask you all sorts of hard questions and tell you that, sure enough, it's not, you know, yeah, I'd go to court with GC mass spec data and maybe some infrared data, but not with an E1/2, okay? E1/2 values vary depending upon the composition of the solution, vary a little bit about when you have impurities in the system, vary due to a lot of parameters that you would control and that you would have to be absolutely 100% sure that you have all these many variables under control to get the absolute exact value. But if you knew that the system, well, it can only be, I have a solution that contains metals. It's not going to be the E1/2 value for the reduction of nitro groups to amine groups, okay, because they're not in there, okay? So with a little bit of chemical knowledge, a little bit of knowledge and understanding of my system, and a little bit of good electrochemistry, I can determine qualitatively what the stuff is. Certainly, if it's at the E1/2 or cadmium, I know it's not lead, it's not copper, it's not zinc, it's not nickel, it's not, okay, they wouldn't come out there. So that gives me qualitative information, and then the IL, the limiting current, gives me the quantitative information, how much of the stuff was in there. And again, typically we do that versus a standard. All right. We talked before about reversible versus irreversible systems. Reversible system is a nice stand-up system because the kinetics are fast and they keep up with the scanning of my potential. If the kinetics are slow or I scan too fast, the curve gets drawn out. And it gets really ugly if it's very irreversible. Okay? So I've got reversible, irreversible, more irreversible, most irreversible. Okay? And then maybe down here I've got wicked irreversible, okay? But at any rate, it's just a difference between how fast I scan and what the kinetics of the system are. If I go really, really slow, the kinetics will keep up. They'll catch up, right? If I scan slow enough, you know, one millivolt per day, okay? And then I'll get my research done and then I'll retire, okay? Okay. So and you can analyze the curves, and you can actually assign rate constants. You can determine the kinetics of the system based on this. The calculations are extremely complicated. Okay, to do electrode kinetics measurements on systems like this. I already told you if you have two things, you get two waves. All right, and. My summary slide, I guess. Let's see, do I have any more? Oh, yeah, I do. Linear scan voltammetry in a stirred system. Normally, we use a platinum or carbon type electrodes that we talked about before. It is better to rotate the electrode than use a stir bar. Linear scan voltammetry, LSV, can be used for quantitative analysis. Just measure IL. We can measure many metal ions and organic compounds. I gave you examples. You can reduce nitro groups to amine groups. You can reduce lots of different organic functional groups and do lots of different metals. It's kind of sensitive, fairly sensitive, due to that convective mass transport situation. No problem there. I faradaic is generally large, but you do have to worry about the capacitive current. The output wave is a the output signal is a wave. Wave, people don't like waves. Okay? I'm not talking about this kind of wave or this kind of wave. Okay, I'm talking about the kind of wave as opposed to a peak, right? And that it can be difficult to perform data analysis on a wave, particularly if the wave is drawn out like an irreversible wave. And also if you have stacked waves, right? Well, gee, they're all stacked up on my computer screen or on my recorder. And it's difficult for me to analyze all of these different waves. Here's an example of a situation where if I have a large amount of one easily reduced species, I've got to reduce that thing before I can reduce this stuff. Okay, I have to get through this wave first before I get this one. This one's small. in concentration compared to this one. I get a small wave for that, and it makes it difficult for me to measure the small amount of this stuff on top of a big wave of this stuff. Okay, so the term is usually said, it's difficult to measure a small amount of one species in the presence of a large amount of a more easily reduced species. This is the more easily reduced thing, and I have to reduce that first before I can go to the other system. Okay, so I said that. There it is. See, I told you people say that. You got to read that on your own time, okay? All right. Okay, we said last class...